All right, thanks everybody for coming. My name is Barry Gritz from the Globe and Mail, and I'll be moderating this morning's discussion with Ryan and Steve for Stand on Guard. Thanks for making it out this rainy Saturday. Let's get started. We'll do a discussion, and then we can open it to the floor for questions after. So thanks for joining me, guys.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us.
This work is obviously going to be of high interest to our homegrown audience here. I think it was of high interest to me. I'm just wondering, you know, Steve, you're Canadian, but Ryan, you're American, and just kind of wondering what the genesis of this story and the conflict between the two nations, how that got started.
Yeah, well, I guess Steve and I met at a film screening of a mutual friends of ours, and my wife was along for the ride, and she was born in Ottawa, and as soon as she and Steve started talking, like, I know she sort of code-switched into Canadian, like, out of American. They immediately just started having this dialogue, and I felt on the outs, which always happens when she meets a fellow Canadian. So I knew I wanted to... My goal of the evening was to try and steal Steve away from Hollywood, because he is one of the most talented in-demand storyboard artists in the world, but I always loved his comic work, so... I wanted to pull him over to our side. And so I think from that first meeting, I started thinking about what is it about Canadians and why do I always end up collaborating with them and why are they such good friends and might they make more interesting enemies potentially?
Yeah, pretty much what Brian said. Brian's wife and I were talking in our secret Canadian language. Yeah, I was actually desperate to get out of storyboarding and get back to comics. I was storyboarding years ago and then kind of always felt like I was a visitor there, and then I eventually get back into comics, and getting to an opportunity to work with Brian was like super appealing and super really exciting, and that's how that started.
Now, kind of talking about Canadian codes, there's a lot of CanCon kind of Easter eggs hidden out throughout this work with Tim Hortons, the little Tobo, the 2112 reference for Rush fans in the audience. Who is the kind of driver behind that?
Well, the littlest Robo actually was my idea. Tim Hortons and that show. I don't know if you guys ever watched that show when you were a kid. Basically, Lassie. It was something that I thought was very boring. We only had like a few channels when I was a kid, so it stuck with me. And yeah, it gets rebooted in 2112.
I picked all the sort of easy, obvious ones like Tim Hortons, but I relied on Steve for the deep cuts. And at one point, some of our prisoner characters have a contraband candy bar, and I said, please just, you know, pick a specific Canadian candy bar. And I found this was more than anything else in the series, the most controversial decision that we made is that Steve picked a Eat More, which is when my wife read it, she was instantly horrified. She's like, it should have been Coffee Crisp. But no one likes Eat More. That is a terrible candy bar. But I mean, you guys are much more passionate about your candy than you are about geopolitics or stances on torture.
Well, that was funny because I know people hate the Eat More candy bar. I don't know why it exists still, but no one ever wants a bite. You have an Eat More, so that's my candy bar. Also, you didn't want anything from Nestle.
Yeah.
Well, that's hard because they own everything. I think Eat More is owned by, I think it was Cadbury, and it's still their own thing now. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I guess since we knew we were talking about war over water and the sort of potential lack of it in the future, that we just wanted to avoid Nestle as much as possible, since I know you guys have a lot of valid concerns with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think you might find more people have more valid concerns over Eat More than Nestle. Talking about the division between this, I mean, you know, the narrative keeps the cause of the war at the central of the story, a little ambiguous toward the end. And it's interesting for the reader, for a Canadian at least, I was approaching it as kind of like a fuck yeah attitude, like, yeah, we're going to take back our land from the Americans. And then I'm getting a little crestfallen toward the end of it, where, you know, a lot more gray areas come up. Was there a lot of conversation between the two of you about the development of that story and the kind of, you know, who was behind this conflict?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if there's a lot about that specifically.
I think we talked about it. We wanted to, you know, at first I wanted our sort of heroic band of Canadians to clearly be the protagonist and the hero of the story. But I wanted over time to sort of make the Americans not just mustache twirly villains, but to show that there might be more to their story. So, I think it was just talking about the victims of invasion, and I think they're not so concerned about why the invasion happened. They're just trying to endure and survive after it happens.
After it happens, there's, I think you gave me some very disturbing dreams about, in terms of torture sequences and innovations in torture, and I really hope that nobody else in the armed forces has picked up with that idea and started running with it. But, where did that idea come from? And has that something you've always been contemplating, the use of torture and the development of making people talk?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that horrifies me, I guess, is the enhanced interrogation and seeing the lengths that my country was willing to go to and probably still is willing to go to. So I think, waterboarding has become pretty commonplace, I think, in fiction. I've seen it so many times, and it's almost it's sort of palatable now. So I think we just wanted to do a scene of torture that was actually difficult to read and to look at, and Steve definitely excelled in that. It's an exceptionally creepy moment. But yeah, we just wanted to think in the future, you know, with the advance of virtual reality, that there are new ways to really hurt people.
It was very disturbed. Not really.
And they were disturbing images, but they weren't necessarily graphic or exploitative.
I guess that's always what the most disturbing stuff is, though, for me, is the stuff that we don't we don't show anything graphic. It's just just as we're putting horrors into our characters' minds, we're doing the same to you as an audience. I know this doesn't sound like a very fun book now, fighting giant robots that we're trying to deeply unsettle you, but I like fiction that's a bit of both, and I like getting to take those hard turns from a fun, action-packed scene to moments of real terror.
I mean, there are some very extraordinarily fun images in this, very cinematic images as well. You know, I think the first thing that came to my mind was the AT-AT walkers from Empire with those giant, the patrollers and up north. And the cinematic references are kind of rife throughout. Steve, was that something that, your time in Hollywood has kind of lent to your work? Or?
Sure. Well, I think I've worked on a bunch of movies with a lot of really great designers who do amazing robots that you've all seen in a million movies. And so it was a bit intimidating to sort of like, okay, now you've got to do your own. How do you make that stand out? And one of Brian's initial notes was, well, the last mech that really had wowed him was the AT-AT, and that sort of put us on the path of kind of having an animalistic element in there. And then I started thinking about, beloved popcorn movies and how they may, kind of influence these future designs. And so what the big sort of gorilla mech in our story is kind of a hybrid of, King Kong meets Godzilla or something, And there's a bit of Geiger's Alien and those, war dogs that are in the earlier issues as well.
Yeah, I think it was just this thinking of Hollywood continues to inform the military-industrial complex in the States, that I think the now situation rooms, actual situation rooms, have started to look like the ones from movies with all the television, giant screens and stuff. And so it's interesting how the military follows Hollywood's lead. So we sort of thought, well, if in 100 years, how the engineers at DARPA, who've been weaned on Star Wars and these other movies, continue to steal those influences and put it into their work. But it was also just an excuse to have some giant fucking robots, because they're cool.
Always welcome, I think. Yeah, I mean, you could see like something like Minority Report now seems almost antiquated in terms of the technology that they were using and the technology that's available to us and to the technology that's available to others that we have no idea.
Definitely.
Were you always approaching the series as a limited six-issue work, basically?
Yeah, I think I've worked on so many ongoing series, and it feels like everything that I do now in Hollywood, they start asking about what will the prequel be and what will the sequel be, and projects aren't ever just allowed to be a story with a beginning, middle, and an end. So, we wanted to do something that was totally self-contained, but also I really miss the characters now that it's over, so I guess never say never, but you know, for now it feels like our story is told.
Yeah, definitely. I was very, very much interested in something that had an ending. I'm a longtime comic reader, and a lot of it is kind of an endless middle. To have something that, you know, has a final act that's, you know, really dramatic, and, you know, no one will be resurrected somehow, it's just really appealing.
Did it make it at all easier to kill the characters within that six-issue arc, then, to know that it was intended to be a standalone thing?
I love killing characters. It's great. It's just a rush of power to be the god of this universe, and you just get to crush these little beings whenever you choose to. No, it's so whether it's ongoing or limited, I love murdering.
I particularly love the death of Highway. If any of you remember that?
Spoiler if you haven't read it yet. It doesn't matter. It doesn't end well for most of our characters. I don't think it'll be a surprise to say if you haven't read it yet.
No, and they had pretty sudden exits for most of them as well. Shocking for a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
The war between America and Canada in the book, however intentionally or not, you know, echoes a lot of the divisive political conversation that's going on right now, especially in the United States. What's your read on that in terms of where America and Canadian relations might be headed in the future?
Yeah, I guess I don't know. I'm hopeful that they will continue to be as good as they are. I guess for me, the book was never really about Canada. I guess I'm still trying to work out my anger about the Iraq invasion. And so, you know, I felt like I'd already done Pride of Baghdad, which was kind of a way of talking about non-combatants and what they go through in war. And I guess now I wanted to do something more like Das Boot or Battle of Algiers, where it's trying to understand our active enemies and maybe even sympathize with them. So I just, I think that's really difficult to do with Middle Eastern countries, to sort of bridge that gap. And Canada is, you know, we share a language and so much culture, and that I thought, you know, this would be an interesting way to take a new look at our opponents by picking them. But it's not because I actually believe we're going to go to war anytime soon, although with the way the election is going now, I guess, you know, anything is possible. I don't know, do you think, what's the future of Canadian-American relations?
Well, I'm hoping to put a good word in for me with the American.
We'll get you a nice cell in the gulag and we come for you guys.
What was your wife's reaction when she, you know, finished reading it?
She loved it. I think she was, I was most taken aback, surprised by, she was really devastated to see Ottawa destroyed in the first issue. It made her cry. And I was like, what? I've seen New York destroyed 1,000 times, you know? She said that's the point, that there's such a rich tradition of America sort of making peace with destroying itself. But she said, I've never seen Ottawa hurt that way. And it was hard to look at. Was it hard to draw?
I thought it was hilarious. I was laughing the whole time. And you notice I don't actually, blow up, a parliament or anything. It's kind of like the moment before everything gets vaporized. You know? So, that was a lot of fun to draw that.
It's any consolation. It's the best Ottawa has ever looked, especially with all that futuristic architecture. I mean, you've really taken it to another.
Yeah, things go well for a long time.
I was wondering if you guys could speak to kind of the benefits and challenges of a creator-owned property like this. Because, you know, it's still a pretty unique thing in the comics world.
Yeah. I can't think of any downsides to it. It's all benefits at this point. That even when I was working at a place like Vertigo, which I love, Vertigo is owned by Warner Brothers, you know, and there's just, when you have this corporate parent, there are a lot of things that you're discouraged from doing, or, you know, that you can't do. And Image, we can do absolutely anything. There are no adults minding the store. We can do, you know, content-wise, we can do whatever we want. And yeah, we can choose to tell a story that's 6 issues. We don't have to continue it if someone wants to. We don't have to make it into a movie. We don't share those rights with anyone. It all belongs to us. So yeah, creatively, it's all win. I guess it's more responsibility that you don't have an editor working with you. We have to do a little bit more ourselves, but I think that trade-off's fair, don't you?
It's amazing. Yeah, it doesn't seem right somehow that we get to do that. There's like literally no influence. It's funny working in you know, in an art department on a movie. You spend 90% of your job over the course of your time on a production is about revision. You know, you're working to find the director's or someone else's realize their vision. You're one of many helping hands. And so when I was on this, it was a little bit like, here's some pages. Any notes? I'm going to change something. And there's nothing. And yeah, that was pretty wild. Even the old Marvel days, you know, there was a lot of there was always, you know, another voice pitching in, but it was pretty awesome to spend all that time and just have it be totally pure, straight from Brian and I, my imagination.
Is there any plans for an adaptation of this work, cinematic, television, otherwise, in the hopper?
Strangely enough, it is something that, yeah, people have been talking about, and yeah, so nothing concrete yet, but there's some exciting opportunities, which are shocking to me, because part of the reason I think I did this is, well, this is never going to be a movie or a TV show, because it's Americans are the bad guys, and the good guys brutally execute one in the opening pages. So I didn't think there would be a real big appetite to turn this into a Hollywood feature or, you know, an ongoing TV series. But I think it's the benefit of comics, is that's this, you know, proven ground where you can do absolutely anything. And I think because the audience was so supportive of it that, yeah, now there's suddenly interest in that field. So, yeah, I think there might be more news in the months to come.
Crossing my fingers for a CDC actor. I know you both have very extensive experiences in Hollywood as well, each of you. I was just kind of wondering if you could touch on some, you know, new work or... Brian, I know you've been working with Paramount on kind of with Michael Chabon, among other people, looking at expanding their cinematic universe with the Hasbro franchise. Would you be able to speak about that a little bit?
No, he'll kill me if I say anything. I had to sign an NDA and then sign a non-disclosure about signing that non-disclosure. Well, I just violated that, I guess, by saying that. No, they don't want me to say anything, but it was fun. It was really cool. And it's sort of... I guess it's what I'm interested in doing now is comics are, that's my life and my passion and my full-time gig, but this was sort of at the right time where just Saga had just gone on hiatus, and this was just 3 weeks, so it sounded fun. So that's sort of how I'm treating Hollywood now, is if there's a fun opportunity to hang out with interesting people, I'll do it, but comics is my focus.
Yeah, definitely, I'm with Brian on that. Yeah, for the most part, I'm not doing any stuff for a movie or a TV. I do a little bit of work on this show, Sense8, that's on Netflix. But for the most part, I'm just focusing on comics.
If you guys haven't watched Sense8, by the way, you should. It's completely batshit, and I can't believe it got made. And it just it's really exciting.
Yes, Steve, I mean, you've had a long history working with the Wachowski siblings.
Yeah.
And that's ongoing for...
Yeah, since pretty much The Matrix, they actually tried to hire me on Bound, but this was in the 90s, and I didn't want to leave the rock-solid world of comics to do this flash-in-the-pan movie thing, so I missed that one, but I've worked on everything else since then. Yeah, they're amazing people and directors. Yeah, all their shows have been great experiences.
I wanted to touch on something. You worked on the storyboards for George Miller's version of Justice League.
Yeah.
I was kind of just wondering if you could speak to what that vision was looking like, especially now that we've seen Zack Snyder's vision of the kind of DC cinematic experience.
It was less mean. Batman was nicer. It was very traditional in a lot of ways. They had a lot of respect for the comics. They read a lot of the comics. They weren't just interested in the aesthetic, but there were lots. It was amazing because it was right before the New 52 started, so I'm sure we had a lot of the same conversations that they were having, and it would be great. He would bring in all these people, his team, and people would just sit around talking about superheroes, and there were all these conversations about, well, it's kind of weird. They all have kind of the same powers, you know, like everyone flies and is super strong, and how do you individuate these characters on the screen with Martian Manhunter and Superman and The Flash are all super strong, super fast. And so, yeah, we just got into the nerd mud, like, super deep. And, yeah, I loved it. I geeked out. It was probably one of my favorite movie jobs of all time. I think it just got too expensive. It was, like, had a massive budget. And, yeah, I guess Warner Brothers kind of chickened out, but...
It had into the writer's strike a little bit as well.
Yeah, that was a big thing, yeah. But they kept us on. They had a script. And so they were, the way George Miller works is he develops a lot of his stories through storyboarding. So you'll sit there with him in a room with you and a couple other artists, and you'll just throw around ideas, and then you'll just, you know, do drawings and or get notes. You do a few drawings, come back for a meeting a day or two later with more drawings, and then you revise that. And it was pretty great. It was cool to watch. You know, Common was walking around the place. He's going to be Green Lantern, and what's the guy's name? He played the Lone Ranger. He was going to be Batman.
Oh, Armie Hammer.
That's him, yeah. So, yeah, it was fantastic. I really geeked out on it. I'm trying to think of...
I got to visit Steve's studio, and he was like, do you want to see any of the George Miller stuff? I was like, are you kidding? This is so cool. And he's got so much stuff. It's heartbreaking. They're like, how much work went into it, and it looks so good. But I love it, just this piece of secret cinema lore, the Justice League movie that wasn't, but it would have been a masterpiece, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. It was funny, and it was pretty, you know, pure to the characters, and it was great. It was great. He's a very cool guy, Mr. Miller. I was very excited, a big fan growing up, so it was like a huge deal for me to get to sit in a room. After about a week or two, I stopped sweating and geeking out and was able to interact normally, so I was proud of that.
Yeah, it's kind of funny just looking back at that time when reports of that film were kind of surfacing and it was a development, and there was kind of like a little mini uproar, like, why are you doing this? Because I think it was the time the Nolan movies were still going strong. But now, in retrospect, you look at it, it's like, oh, the Fury Road guy, yeah, and you know, compared with the
version
of
the
characters that have come before it, there's a big nostalgia for something that's never been, or that may, you know, that never will.
Yeah, I know. It's a huge trend now to do these documentaries about movies that never got made, which is pretty wild. I think there's one in development for this movie. Yeah, it was hugely nostalgic, but yeah, it was great.
That's how it goes. It's shocking to when you work in Hollywood to see how much money they spend on things that will never happen. It's just the, you know...
Yeah.
Gross domestic product of developing countries just being spent on things that just end up in a black hole it's wild.
The art, especially this movie, it was supposed to be the big Warner's tentpole, and so the artwork and models that were generated and the costumes, I mean, they fully had like figured out Superman's world and, you know, Atlantis and Paradise Island and stuff. They had a lot of really, a lot of it looks, you know, in the new versions. I mean, Warner's owns all that stuff, so I don't know if they ever refer back to it. You know, you see kind of sort of a similar evolution to these the movies that are coming out now. Yeah, it was great.
I just want to close things off with that. Brian, how much French did you know before writing this book?
I took 6 years of French, and I know zero French. I don't remember any of it. Relied on a friend who I met through Cirque du Soleil, Mathieu Chalifou, and said, I need your help, but I'm going to annoy you because I want to translate things, but I want it to be recognizable to people who perhaps don't speak French, so I'm going to occasionally alter it to, and I'll just use the excuse of it's 100 years in the future and the language has evolved, but if there's any French mistakes that you hate, I take full responsibility for it, but we did have someone from Quebec working hard to make sure that it looked vaguely authentic, at least.
Awesome. Okay, now I'd like to open up the floor to any questions. Feel free to raise your hand. Yes, you, sir.
Question for Brian. Politics is a big character in a lot of your work, and I'm wondering how you've perhaps remained not a cynic as you see what's going on today and how things are progressing in your country.
Oh, I don't think I have. I'm a cynic. I'm pretty cynical about all this, but I guess I just... I'm often confused about politics, I guess, more than I am passionate about it. So I never just want to write a preachy, you know, here's my opinion on matters. I would just write an op-ed for the newspaper, I guess, if I felt that. It's more, I like comics as a place to sort of ask myself questions or sort of use fiction to explore things that I'm confused about. So, but through the process, I found myself getting more cynical and sad and worried for my children now that I have some. But we'll see. Let's see how this next election goes.
Questions for both Brian
and
Steve. You guys are actually both personal heroes in life because you started in comics, moved into Hollywood in different ways, and then came back to comics. I myself am an actor hoping to get to comics, and it's interesting, you know, where you're working in that kind of medium, whether it's film or TV, you really are just part of the process. And comics, you guys are talking about how it's different, or, you know, for example, Steve, you're saying you're a story artist, you know, revisions a lot, there's a lot of voices. Brian, I'm sure, for you, you know, being the writer's room, you're consulting with a lot of people, and there's a lot of different moving parts. And then you guys come back to comics, and it's really just the two of you guys working on this project. You find, you guys talked about how it's nice to just have the two of you along with maybe a smaller team, but do you find that working in comics is a lot more personal? And because you obviously the quality of work what you guys are trying to do is trying to basically put yourself in someone else's vision, but is it just sort of nice to be like, this really does represent me or us, or and just like own that as well?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, as an artist, especially, I mean, for some people, working and designing robots for movies, all they wanted to do, and that's great, and working on movies is great, but all I ever wanted to do was draw comics, and so, yeah, being able to get back into that, and yeah, having a, some kind of, like, sense of, you know, authorship, like, you know, you're one of the, you know, few people that helped create this thing, it's, like, really gratifying, especially when it's, like, Brian's script, and, you know, you'd be totally buying this comic yourself, and, you know, getting to draw it, it's like, you know, those drawings down in the garden, there's a lot of work, probably in a lot of ways more work than working on a movie, because you don't get to just, you've got to get those pages done. You can't just, on a movie, you have a bad day, well, you come back tomorrow or whatever, you know. But comics, you're kind of working all the time, so you really have to love it. And yeah, I was kind of, you know, walking on the air for you know, a long time there.
Yeah, I love film and TV, but I don't really have a sense of ownership over any of that work. It's so collaborative, and you have so many bosses and so many voices you have to listen to, but comics is just us. It's, for me, it's the perfect amount of collaboration, but also, I think, with all the artists I work with, we all sort of leave each other alone when it's our time to, you know, Steve's not looking over my shoulder telling me how to write my script, and I don't tell him to redraw pages or anything. We give each other a lot of trust and space. So I love it. But yeah, I think it's harder to break into comics, I think, than maybe Hollywood. There's so many avenues that you can break into film and television, and comics feels like there are very few. So they're challenging, but I think they're both worth it. If you can explore both, I think they feed each other. So.
Yeah, I've become a better artist too, working on movies. You know, also having that exposure to how other people work, and you know, needing to be professional and working in a working environment with other people is a lot better than, or has taught me a lot more than, say, the time I spent working at Marvel in my house by myself. You know, so yeah, definitely, it was great to sort of, I don't know, go up the mountain and get some movie ninja training, and then come back to comics.
Yeah, I've heard film described as it's sort of like, even if you're directing a movie, it's sort of like you're just holding on to this dragon that, like, you can't steer it. You can kind of nudge it in one direction or another, but you're just holding on for dear life. Whereas comics, it feels like you're riding this Tron light cycle that you can take anywhere you want to, and it does whatever you want. I don't know how I got lost in this Tron dragon analogy, but I like comics. The end.
Yes, you, ma'am.
First off, I just want to say thanks for believing the faith that in 100 years the CBC will still exist. It seemed for a while with a certain government it wasn't going to, so thank you.
Sure.
It gave me great hope.
Do you work for them?
What was that?
Do you work for the CBC or
yes,
with them?
Oh, cool.
Understood.
Also, Brian, your words are amazing and they mean a lot. But I just feel like all the artists you collaborate with enhance your work so much, and more so than any other comics I read. How do you go about your process of finding artists to work on certain projects?
Yeah, I guess I see people I like and just seek them out, but I'm not too promiscuous, I guess. I mean, I've worked with, you know, the same few people for a really long time, and thanks, it's nice of you to say. I guess it was just, I had a realization a few years ago that it was, oh, comics is not a writer's medium, it's an artist's medium, and I need them a lot more than they need me. And that was sort of a turning point. I think my scripts got better, and my comics got better. Because I think when I broke in, like everyone, it was sort of this era of, it's about Alan Moore, and it was really driven by writers, and it was sort of incidental. You'd have sort of a rotating cast of artists, and I hate that. I think that I like having the same people doing the same story forever, so I think... I try and seek them out and make sure they get paid well, and give them the space to do great work.
Yeah, Brian writes great, super great, concise scripts that are like easy to refer to. I mean, you know, I've worked with a lot of writers in the olden days, and it was like there's a lot of, you know, kind of superfluous, you know, confusing extra stuff on those script pages, and Brian's really like super tight, super clean, and because, you know, you're constantly referring to these things, and a pleasure.
That's just born out of laziness. My scripts have gotten so bare bones. It's all
well,
about
not bare bones. They're just precise. You don't you know where the heart of the characters are on every page, and helps with the acting of the characters and everything.
Well, thanks. I had heard a story once about there's one artist who's working with a writer, and the writer would write really long scripts and have sort of asides and anecdotes in it, and this artist would just give the scripts to his wife at the start of the month and say, just highlight what I'm supposed to draw. I don't want to see anything else. And it's like, oh yeah, their job is really hard and they've got a lot of work to do. Just get down to business and say, here's what's on the page and here's some reference that I dug up if it helps save time, but also give your artist the leeway that, you know, what might take me a page, an hour to write is going to be at least a day or two of their life. And so they're inevitably going to come up with a better way to do it than you thought of. So just to give them the permission and freedom to follow their muse.
Yes, sir.
You kind of just started talking about it, but do you have any other tips about writing for comics for new writers?
Yeah, I think just do it, I guess, at this point. Like, when I started, it was still the era of you would do mini-comics, and you would photocopy them and staple them together, and, like, but now Tumblr is that, but it's that with a potential audience, you know? So I think just start making stories. And the big thing is, though, you're going to have to find an artist to draw. I'd say start with something short, you know, 8-page stories or whatever, and then find a collaborator. But I think the advice that I give that people always hate to hear is if you want to find a good artist to draw your story, you have to pay them. And I think there are people always think you can just go online and be like, hey, does anyone want to draw this thing I wrote? And they don't. No one does. That's a huge pain in the ass. But I think if you work hard and you set aside money and say, I'm not going to take a vacation, or I'm not going to buy a PlayStation, I'm just going to set aside $400 and try and find someone great to draw this thing that I've written. And with $400, you'll find a great, amazing artist online. And and then just do it. Write a script and have them draw it and put it up online. And you will learn way more than taking any classes or reading any books. I think it's the only way to learn how to do comics is to do it and to just try and do as much of it as you can, as quickly as you can. So, yeah, I'd say start writing short stories, find artists, pay them even if it's just $10 a page or something small. But, see how it goes.
Yes, sir?
The character is less than that. So I'm fully bilingual. I was reading it, and I think I got to issue 3 before I realized, wait, you're speaking French, and I guess half the audience probably, or more than half the audience probably doesn't know what he's saying. What was the decision to put all this dialogue in French instead of, translated in brackets or something like that?
I guess I had visited Quebec and no one was translating for me. I just, everyone would just slip into French immediately and I would just be terrified and lost. And I thought, oh, that would be a fun character to just put that in and similarly have, perhaps a lot of American readers be lost. But, language is an obsession of mine. It's something we play with in Saga, where we'll have huge sections that will just be in a seemingly alien language. But I think that's the joy of comics, that I don't think you were the only person who wasn't lost, that Steve's artwork is so clear that even, if it had been Sanskrit, I think you're able to, thanks to the medium of comics, you can follow, you can get the gist of what people are saying. So the images always transcend words. So. Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Thanks. Well, Steve is a huge part of that, but I think it was also early on talking with my wife and just asking her, sort of going province by province and saying, what are the cliches here? And, she would rattle them off and then I would say, all right, well, let's do our best, to avoid that. But, it's just, I love assembling a team and just trying to find a diverse lineup and also, thinking about what Canada's future would be like. And I remember when I visited that same trip to Quebec, I was listening to the radio and there were 2 Canadian politicians and they were arguing about Syrian refugees. But one was arguing like, we should take a lot. And the other person was saying, no, we should take a super lot. And in the States, it's like, we won't take, women and children. Like, no, that won't be allowed. And I just, I thought about, well, what will those Syrian refugees be like in 100 years and how would they feel about, going to war with the States where they may have wanted to end up originally. So, I think it was just trying to look at the reality of Canada now and just tweaking it slightly to how it might be in 100 years. But is there anything you did visually to avoid?
I wanted more stereotypes. You rejected my idea for a futuristic cyber bounty. That'll be my next creator on the project.
Which sounds really good. Definitely better, and I think whenever you have more outlets, it's good. And I think there are always trade-offs. That it's still, the more freedom you have creatively, the less money you have to do it. And I never mind that in comics because we have such low overhead. But if you start doing TV and you're like, I don't need a lot of money, then you realize, you don't get very good actors, and you don't get to have special effects, and your music is terrible. So there, there will always be trade-offs, but. I found, working in comics, there would always be people who would be like, I'm a Marvel guy or I'm a DC guy. And those are just companies. And each company has good people who work there and each company has terrible people. So I think film and television is the same. There are more places to go. But You just have to find people that you trust to work with. But I think there's probably the potential for there to be another great commercial network broadcast television show. I think it's much harder, but it's possible.
In the back.
You mentioned that comics is an artist's medium. I'm just wondering, as a writer, why do you like working in a medium that's so visual?
It's easier. I have someone else to do the heavy lifting. It's I sometimes dabble in prose, and just all the heavy lifting of setting place and describing what's going on. Like, I just want to get to the dialogue. That's the fun stuff to write, and let the artist do all of this hard shit. So I love that. I guess giving that power over to someone else is I'm very happy to.
It
baffles me too now that I've got two small kids and we read children's books, and it always have the author's name, you know, a huge type, and then somewhere in the bottom we look at illustrations by so and so, and like, there are 10 words in this whole book. Like, this guy, you know, 15 minutes to jam this out. You know, these lavish painted pages that would be years, and it's always so unfair. And I think it's because, you know, writers are often, you know, critics are usually writers, and they focus on the writing. And I just think there's this tradition of, elevating the writer and downgrading the artist. And it's crazy if you spend any time there just knowing how much more important it is to the process. But I love them. I can't draw to save my life. And I would see, Alan Moore or Grant Morrison, like, their doodles, and they're great. Like, those guys could get work as comic artists. So I feel like I am truly the worst artist in all of comics. I'm so humbled that I need this help, but I'm grateful for it. I like working with him. But Steve, I'll say, is, along with being a world-class artist, is also an excellent writer himself, and he's written some Wolverine in the past, if any of you out there has read. It's terrific.
A lot of Twilight fanfic as well.
But like with every artist I've worked with, I'm excited and trying to push them out of the nest to say, do you see how easy it is what I do? You can do this too. I just want to read a full Steve comic that's 100% him. So I'm hopeful that might be coming in the not-too-distant future.
You gotta get some sucker to draw this thing, though.
That's the rub.
Yes, sir?
For both of you guys, in terms of creating the characters, like textually and in terms of visually, do you spend a lot of time doing process work, like writing character histories or journaling or writing more for that character, or like a lot of time imagining what that character could look like or behave?
I guess I've heard of people who they'll create sort of dossiers about their characters beforehand, about they know what their favorite breakfast cereal is and where they went to high school. But for me, I never know the character until I see what they're going to look like. So at the beginning, I just sent Steve, I think, maybe two or three lines, tops, about each character. Here's Dunn, here's where he's from, he's lost his husband in the initial invasion. But not much more than that. And then it's not until Steve comes back with extraordinary sketches of the characters that then once I see them, I'm like, oh, now I know where they went to high school, and now I know what they look like. So it's sort of this casting process where, like, I put out the two-line casting call and then wait for the artist to come. And along with being great directors and cinematographers, like, I think Steve's performances are second to none in comics. He just really lovely, subtle performances he gets out of people. So, just the second he sent over the first image of it, I don't think there's anyone who went back to. We took a second stab at. There's pretty much your first take on everyone is what we ended up with, right?
Sort of. They do kind of evolve as you draw them more and more. That's actually one of the funnest parts is getting those initial descriptions and trying to figure out and give each character, particularly with Stan on guard, trying to come up with something that's futuristic and kind of utilitarian, and it's supposed to be, even though it's got all the sci-fi stuff in it, you want some kind of reality and feels grounded. And yeah, they're initial sketches. I think what happens is, you know, I'll send some to Brian and you'll get some notes, and then over time you'll kind of like certain things will, like initially Dunn had this axe that he was going to, I don't know, I was in love with his axe. It was like, basically I just drew an axe and then this character just evolved out of, you know, needing someone to hold this thing. And then the axe isn't in the book. I just sort of forgot.
I really dropped the ball. Sorry about not giving a good axe scene.
Well, it wasn't really that important, but it's, yeah, you'll start on, like, you know, fixated on some funny detail, and then, character design will evolve out of that.
Yes, sir.
Just kind of touching on some of the politics stuff that's been brought up because of the book, I think. Brian, you were saying that you were two politicians kind of arguing to Quebec politicians about we should help or we should help more. And I know with that issue, like, you know, the U.S. has a stance on that issue, Canada has sort of taken tentative, sort of taken opposite sides. And I was wondering, is it, you know, you don't think into your personal views of it or whatever, but is it interesting to be, this is actually for both, I'm sorry, this is just kind of for both you guys, but, you know, the country here, everybody, I think, both countries, we had different opinions on that issue, but one country took one stance, another country took another, and is it interesting to be from both sides of that, but to maybe see how, I don't know, I guess I'm trying to say it's like, even though one country took one side, we were all going through the same questions, and we were all having the same discussion.
Right.
Regardless of where your country sort of took you. And is that kind of an interesting thing where, or if you find it interesting, the fact that even though we're on opposite sides, as people, we are still debating this question, should we do what's right or should we do what's safe?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that there's, you know, and I think it's just trying to remember it's never Canada versus America stands, that there's, you know, as much diversity in opinions here in your country as there is in mine, that there's no sort of hive mind, even though we elect politicians who I think end up, you know, representing one side or the other, that, people are just individuals. And, I don't know, not being very articulate about our international relations. How do you feel about it? Do you like people from the States? Do you get along with them?
I like half of them.
I guess it's sometimes I'll talk with Canadians and they'll say, well, it's just your country is so vast. It's just it's too big, and you know, there are just too many different people that it's yeah, I don't know. I guess being married to a Canadian, this is a question that comes up all the time. That I think usually my politics tend to be more aligned with the average Canadian, I suspect, than the average.
If you kind of get into your little bubble, like I know a lot of Americans, I have a lot of American friends, they're awesome. They all have kind of more, kind of liberal views on things. They're, and I don't know, you know, that very, but then again, you know, my brother moved to America. He's a citizen now, and he's going to vote for Trump, and, you know, my head explodes. It doesn't make any sense. What are you doing? But, you know, he likes it. He thinks it's a good idea, and, you know, he's still my brother, and, you know, I'll probably talk to him again.
This is like the American Civil War now, when it's going to be brother versus brother. It's going to take up, he's going to be piloting the giant robot now, stomping across the border, and you're going to have to defend your country. Are you ready?
Well, I got a big family.
I think we have time for one more question. Somebody
yes.
Has there been a difference in reaction to the book? I know you did signings on Canada Day and Independence Day and the opposite countries. So have you noticed, or is everyone just taking it with a kind of fun grain of salt?
Everyone's always nice at signings, because I think if you wait in line, people very rarely wait to say you stink. But the fun part is we had a letter column where we take, you know, letters from everyone, and that got some really fun responses of how dare you suggest that America would ever invade a country for unprovoked over resources, or like this is madness. So Yeah, I always enjoyed those. So there were some angry people. But no, I think for the most part, part of the reason that I do love my country is that I think we have a pretty high tolerance for showing ourselves in a negative light. I think especially, you know, that this is 100 years from now. I think people recognize that we weren't necessarily commenting on this administration. But no, I'd say it's been overwhelmingly positive. People have been so nice about it. So all credit to Steve for that.
Oh, sure. Too nice. I love the negative comments. They got a kick out of it. I got a guy on Facebook who once private messaged me and was like, you know, I don't like this story. I don't like the artwork. And, yeah, I'm not afraid to admit this, but I'm a proud American. I was like, oh, well, you know, of course. I thought that was hilarious.
that we should put that as a blurb on the back of the book.
Thanks for trying it out, sir. Hopefully we'll come back for the next one.
Oh, I see. You're so Canadian. That's your response. That's just nice. Go F yourself. That's how we do it in the States, Steve.
There was a moment where I was like, you know, my wife kind of, I wasn't charged up or anything, but I wanted to, like, I don't know. It wasn't a good idea. My wife talked me out of it, but I was like, what the hell do you know about, you know? But, just to see, but that wouldn't have been a smart move, I don't think.
Well, thank you guys again. I think we're going to be signing immediately after this somewhere.
Yeah,
so if anyone says to scribble in your stuff, we'll be here.
Yeah, well, thanks, Brian and Steve, for coming. Thanks, you guys, for coming out and asking questions. And enjoy the rest of the weekend.